Welcome to the Bylines Network podcast, an audio accompaniment to our growing family of regional Bylines publications.
This week, with some major legislation being passed through the Commons and being announced as well, I spoke to a series of experts on what all of these new laws mean and what the impact of their passage will be.
I'm Julian Greenbank in West England.
And I'm Alex Toll, up in New York.
So Alex, a big week if you're an MP, I suppose. Going to be very busy.
Yeah, so we've got a series of laws that have been either announced in the Commons, so they've had their first reading, or they're having their second reading, which is kind of the main part where they're actually debated, where amendments get added, or their third reading, where they get sent off to the Lords. So what is happening where? First off, we've had the publication and first reading of two bills. The Borders Bill, under the Home Secretary, Priti Patel, and also the Elections Bill. And now we've had the third reading of the Police Crime Sentencing and Courts Bill, which has already sort of got a lot of controversy, and which has several quite harsh restrictions on freedom of protest and freedom of expression. So I talked to a really interesting series of experts about this. So first off, I talked with Tom Brake, who is the director of Unlock Democracy, about the Elections Bill. Then I talked to Mitchell Westra of Open Britain about the PSCS bill. And then finally, I talked to Stella Parrott. Stella is a former civil servant and an expert on home affairs, who we talked to about the Borders Bill. So first off, we've got our interview with Tom about the Elections Bill. So we are delighted to be joined once again by Tom Brake, the director of Unlock Democracy. Tom, thanks for speaking with us today.
My pleasure.
So you've been very outspoken about talking about this latest bill, the Electoral Integrity Bill, and what it's going to do. So what do you see as the main problems which the government is trying to identify and sort of solve with this piece of legislation?
Well, firstly, perhaps out of a sense of embarrassment, the government have changed the name of the bill from Electoral Integrity Bill just to Elections Bill. So maybe they're not so focused on integrity after all. Now, first of all, there are proposals in this bill that we would support. So, for instance, there is a proposal that will mean that party campaigners cannot collect postal votes in the future. That is welcome. The guidance so far from the Electoral Commission has indicated that party campaigners probably shouldn't be doing that, but this will now make it clear that they can't. What I think is particularly interesting about this is that just as at the last election, Michael Gove, who is the senior minister in the Cabinet Office, was actually encouraging through letters coming from him, people to send back their postal votes to him. So he was actually guilty of harvesting postal votes himself. So it's interesting that one of the people who's going to be directly affected by this proposal is Michael Gove.
Yes.
There are other proposals in the bill that are equally we would support. So for instance, there is a measure that will make it there'll be an electoral sanction against people who are attacking campaigners. That is welcome. Whether it's council candidates or parliamentary candidates, will experience some quite horrific abuse online. And that measure, if it can help to clamp down on that, will be welcome and may encourage other people to go into politics who at the moment are completely put off because of that abuse. And finally, for instance, in terms of positive proposals, there is a first step to trying to tackle the issue of digital campaigning with the equivalent of a digital imprint. So in other words, at the moment, if a party publishes a leaflet, there has to be an imprint on it so that you can trace back to the source. And there is now going to be a proposal to require that to happen in relation to digital advertising as well. So that's welcome. However, what is not at all welcome in this bill are the proposals around voter ID. Now, this is a very costly proposal, which frankly is not necessary. And it is strange that rather than investing tens of millions of pounds in this proposal, that the government haven't chosen instead to launch a major registration drive for voters, because the big issue in terms of voting is the millions of people who are not on the register, who are entitled to vote. And those are the people I think the government, any government, should be focusing on to try to ensure that they can participate in a democratic process.
Yes, absolutely. And covered a really wide range of both the good and the bad in that bill. Now, you've obviously had experience in Parliament yourself as an MP. So what do you think the chances are of this bill kind of going through unamended?
Clearly, the government have a large majority. So that makes it more difficult in terms of amendments. And the government, particularly in relation to voter ID, have been deaf, I think, to the representations that have been made by a very wide range of organisations. But what has also happened, which sort of the coincidence in timing was of great interest, and that was the fact that the Committee on Standards in Public Life yesterday published their own report. So they're an independent committee. The current chair, Lord Evans, was appointed by the previous Prime Minister, Theresa May. And they produced a report with 47 recommendations about ways in which the government could improve voting integrity, trust in our elections. What I hope is going to happen, and in fact, I'm writing to the Prime Minister to make this point, is that the Prime Minister will allow some changes to be made to the Elections Bill to take on board many, if not all, of those proposals, because if those were included into the bill, and the bill, many of those, perhaps not all of them, but a very large number of those recommendations will be in scope for this bill, and that could make a huge difference to trust in our elections. So we have to wait and see whether the Prime Minister is willing to do that, but it is it would be unfortunate if the government one day publish an elections bill and on the next day an independent committee produces a wide range of very sensible recommendations, only for the government then to say, well, actually, sorry, but we're not going to take any of those on board.
Yes, absolutely. And we can only hope that that will happen. What do you think will be the actual impact of this bill, do you think?
I am willing to bet that the impact of this bill, particularly in relation to the voter ID aspects of it, will be exactly what happened in Northern Ireland. In Northern Ireland in 2003, a requirement to have photographic ID was introduced. Prior to that in Northern Ireland, there was already a requirement to have ID, but it just wasn't at that point photo ID. So they introduced the requirement for photo ID in 2003. And what happened in all of the elections subsequently is that voter turnout went down. Now that, and that is from the government's own figures, I find it rather distressing that the Chloe Smith, who's the minister in charge of that particular area, continues to say that it had no impact. Her own figures, and in fact a letter that I have had from her department since, confirms that it did have the effect of reducing voter turnout. So we've had that experience in Northern Ireland. It's very hard to see why introducing photographic ID in the UK wouldn't have the same effect. And that's for a number of reasons. Not, first of all, it's very clear that there are people who currently don't have photographic ID. Now, the government's response to that is that they'll be able to get free ID from their local council. Well, first of all, that's not free, because what it'll mean is the council taxpayer will be paying for the so-called free voter ID for voters who don't have identification. There will be people who, for whatever reason, feel uncomfortable engaging with authority, so to speak, who previously would have been quite happy to turn up to vote, but now are reluctant perhaps to make contact with their local council. There'll be some people, frankly, who are too busy. If they are juggling three jobs, children, possibly the last thing on their mind is going to be to take time out to go and visit their local authority or log on, if it can be done online, to secure a so-called free voter ID. So that's going to discourage people. And then, of course, what is inevitably going to happen is that some people are forgetful and they will turn up at their polling station. without remembering to take voter ID with them. And whereas previously, of course, by giving their name and address, they would have been able to. Now, if they turn up and either they're heavily committed for the rest of the day, they can't go back, or they turn up just before close of poll, there's not time to go home. So we can see that the impact of this will be fewer people are going to take part in elections.
Yes, and hopefully we can do all that we can to get the message out about getting people to bring that voter ID. But for anyone who's listening who is concerned, who wants to sort of raise their objections, what can they do in the short term to make their voices heard?
Well, clearly there are a number of organisations, including ours, Unlock Democracy, but also the Electoral Reform Society, who are campaigning on this issue. So, you know, take part many of those campaigns. You don't have to be a member of the organisation. You can just join as a supporter and support those campaigns. Or people can, of course, write individually to their members of parliament. So the elections bill, so we've had the, what we've had is the first reading. So in other words, the bill has been published, but there hasn't been a debate yet. So there'll be the second reading coming up soon. So members of the public can lobby their member of parliament in advance of that and say, I want you to take part in the debate, and these are the points that I want you to make. And of course, there will be further points during the bill's passage, the committee stage in the Commons, the report stage in the Commons, and then, of course, the Lords, where there will be many opportunities for people to lobby their Member of Parliament. And what I'd suggest is that the more personalised this is, the better. So, for instance, if, for instance, there are members of the public who for instance, don't have voter ID and may... can envisage there may be difficulties to securing one, either because they couldn't go to their local authority, perhaps that it might be a huge distance to travel, they've got no means of travel, or perhaps they're not very tech savvy if it's going to be something that's done online. When they make representations to members of parliament, they should write that in, because that is the sort of thing that will stick in a member of parliament's mind and might just shift a few votes in the other direction.
Yes, and we will hope for that. Well, thank you so much for speaking with us today, Tom, and best of luck with all of your endeavours going forward.
Thank you very much, Alex. Pleasure talking to you again.
Thank you so much, Tom Brake, for speaking with us. I'm sure we are going to be keeping a very close eye on this bill as it makes its way through Parliament.
Up next, we've got our interview with Mitchell Westra. Mitchell is the Operations Director at Open Britain, and he was kind enough to speak to us about the police crime sentencing and courts bill. So we are delighted to be joined today by Mitchell Westra. Mitchell is the operations director at Open Britain. Mitchell, thanks for joining us today.
Brilliant, Alex. Thanks for having me on.
So we're doing a kind of this quick sort of rundown of all of the legislation that has been going through Parliament or getting announced this week. And we really wanted to talk to you about the police crime sentencing and courts bill that's in the Commons right now. It just had its second reading this week, I believe. What do you sort of see as the sort of problem which the government has identified, which they want to sort of resolve with this bill?
The PCSC bill has actually just gone to the Lords. It passed its third reading last week. There are some really interesting parts of this bill, because the argument that the government is making is that this is increasing sentencing, that it's got some, you know, some really good aspects of it in terms of how that runs through the courts. But the problem with the bill is around, really, in my view, around protesting. So what this does is introduces 10-year sentences for anybody who causes or could potentially cause serious annoyance. And we know that protests cause serious annoyance to lots of people, particularly when you're in commuter cities and when they're protesting outside tube stations and that kind of thing. It can be really annoying. But it broadens the definition of protester. So it starts to look at individuals causing serious annoyance to any member of the public, or any section of the public. So that could take in one individual sitting outside Parliament with a loudspeaker, which I know has been quite a common occurrence over the last few years. So that's the number one thing that I would identify as a problem with this bill. And obviously huge protests on the protest bill, the Kill the Bill movement that's been going on for the last couple of months, has really identified that the public are not happy with this, but the government is looking to force it through anyway.
Yes, and obviously sort of amendments can be added in the Lords, but often they may just kind of get repealed, this whole process of ping pong, where the Lords and the Commons kind of bounce back legislation between each other may well continue. Often one of the interesting things about this bill, of course, is that it affects what is essentially a devolved function in terms of policing. So this will be up to individual police forces and individual police and crime commissioners to enforce. So have you sort of seen any issues with that sort of variance of policing throughout the country, particularly, as you kind of said, with this Kill the Bill movement that's been enforced in very different ways depending on which police force has been involved?
It has been really interesting throughout the pandemic, particularly looking at the way different police forces have approached protest. And I think that this bill isn't actually going to do anything useful, because when you look at the way police and crime commissioners will now be developing their public consultation processes, they'll be going through that process at the moment where they're trying to consult with the public on what the priorities are. This is going to be a much bigger problem in some areas than others. Given the reporting that we had last week, I think it might have been the week before now, where we found that police in London and in Bristol had breached fundamental rights with their existing powers. So adding new powers just seems like a solution in need of a problem.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we saw those scenes with the Sarah Everard vigil, which again was during coronavirus lockdown, but did see police using highly sort of excessive force and received sort of widespread condemnation, not just in the UK, but internationally. One thing which I was kind of curious about was what you and Open Britain do see as the problems with policing, which could be fixed. And this is one bill, but there does seem to be this kind of clamour across the country for wider reforms of policing more generally that don't just get solved by longer sentences.
Yeah, and don't necessarily get solved by increasing the number of police either, because, you know, that's been the Conservative government over the last 11 years, I think it is, have removed large numbers of police and are now taking credit for replacing them. But I think the reality is that police are involved now in things that aren't the traditional role of police. They're involved in mental health support and community support that the police have not traditionally been required to get involved in. I think it's a broader societal change that is, are the police the right people to deal with the problem at hand? Or actually, is there a more appropriate service? And is that service adequately funded and resourced to deal with the problems that are presenting themselves?
Yes, definitely. And obviously we've seen this sort of big movement in the US around police reform, but that's mostly yet to come here. And obviously some individual police and crime commissions have been doing that quite interestingly in places like Humberside and County Durham, but that's not necessarily been applied to the widespread. Are there any other problems which you see with this bill in its current form?
We've really focused on the specific aspect of protest because we think that that is the fundamental aspect of democracy and expressing views. You know, these things are protected by the European Convention on Human Rights, and any changes to that really need to be heavily and carefully scrutinized, which the government is not particularly keen on scrutiny, we know. Specifically, they've passed things through Parliament very, very quickly without actually giving them the committee stages that you might have expected under a different government. But that's, you know, that power of democracy and the power of the freedom of speech that comes with it are really important and I think should never be curtailed.
Yes, absolutely. And it's really good to see groups like Open Britain doing something about this. Could you talk a little bit more about that, about what Open Britain is doing? And I'm sure lots of our listeners are concerned about this bill, what they can do if they want to voice those concerns.
Yeah, it's not too late to stop the Police Crime Sentencing and Courts Bill, PCSC Bill. The amendments, as you mentioned, I'm expecting amendments to come out of the House of Lords. When it returns to the House of Commons, the kind of ping pong process where the House of Lords amendments are then voted on by the House of Commons. Any changes to the amendments go back to the House of Lords, and this process can go on for a really long time. We'll see whether or not there are big debates and big votes in both houses over the next few months, I think. I would expect that we'll be encouraging MPs to back any amendments that do remove the rights, the changes to the powers of police. That it's impossible really to say exactly what is going to happen until we see the details of those amendments.
Yes, absolutely, and best of luck with that when it happens.
Thank you very much.
Again, thank you to Mitchell for speaking with us today, and be sure to check out all of his work and Open Britain's on the PCSE bill up in Parliament over the next couple of weeks. And finally, I spoke with Stella Parrott about the Borders Bill, which got announced in Parliament this week. Stella is a Yorkshire Bylands writer, and some of her work on this bill will also be appearing in there over the coming weeks, so be sure to check that out as well. We are delighted to be joined today by Dr. Stella Parrott. Stella, thanks for joining us. Could you tell us a little bit about yourself and your background?
Right. I've been involved with immigration and refugees since about 1979, when I first started working with prisoners who were due to be deported from the UK, mainly Colombian drug dealers at that time, but also some terrorist offences, female terrorist offenders that were due to be deported. So that's where my interest began in relation to that. And that's continued. I spent a lot of time working in the criminal justice system, a lot of time working with refugees.
Today we are talking about the government's new Borders Bill, which you've already written about in an article upcoming in Yorkshire Bylines. Could you run down briefly, I guess, sort of what the imagined problem that the government is trying to sort of tackle in this bill?
The government states that it's trying to tackle three problems. One, it maintains that the current system is neither fair nor firm, and that it needs to be reformed to be fairer and to be more effective. The second aim is that it wants to deter what they call illegal entry into the UK. And the third aim is to more quickly remove people who they would argue have no right to be in the UK. So those are the aims of the bill. I think it would be fair to say that the immigration system is in a mess. And not all of that is the current or previous government's doing. I think the world has moved on. It has changed over the last two decades. There are many more refugees since 2010, you know, in the last 10 years than we had previously. Refugees come from different parts of the world. The world has become a bit more unstable. Climate change has put other pressures on things like food and natural resources. So the demands are different, the demands are greater. Current systems, procedures, organisations and legislation don't always reflect the modern world or the challenges that governments face. So I think they're right to be seeking to make changes to the immigration system. And I think they're right to be making changes to the immigration system following Brexit. Whether this bill will make it more coherent, I think that's debatable. I think there are some elements of it that might, but all the indications are that it certainly won't make it fairer. And the government has yet to define for whom they think it should be fairer. You know, that might be the people who are seeking asylum, who wish to come to the UK as regular migrants. It might be the refugees who are already here, or it might be the British population. You know, there is no definition of for whom they want the system to be fairer.
Yeah, absolutely. Could you quickly run through essentially what happens, what the system looks like? So if someone wants to apply for asylum in the UK, how do they go about that? And how will this bill impact that process?
At the moment, because we're an island, most of the people who arrive in the UK claim asylum as soon as they hit our shores or hit the tarmac at an airport. This is the last place on their journey. So they will immediately say that they are seeking asylum. And that means that they will immediately go into the system. If they go into the system, that means that there's a sort of introductory process where they are checked to see whether they are likely to be terrorists or pose some public threat. If they are considered to pose a public threat, they're immediately detained. If they're not, generally they may be accommodated in somewhere such as Napier Barracks, and then at some time in the future they may be moved on. The government has used, and particularly through coronavirus, has used hotels for that purpose. Hotels have been closed, obviously, to the tourist industry. So the government housed refugees in hotels while their claims were being processed and heard. Prior to coronavirus, most of them were housed in accommodation provided by private companies, and the accommodation was notoriously bad. I mean, we're talking about rat-infested, dangerous hovels that refugees were put in. The system that they go through, the requirement is for them to prove that they are entitled to be given asylum. So the paperwork about where they lived, who they are, how they got here, what the risks are that they faced, it's up to them to be able to provide details in relation to that. Some of those details are more readily accepted than others. So, for example, if there's a refugee from Syria, everybody knows that there's a war in Syria. So immigration officials are much more accepting that indeed, the fact that they come from Syria is proof that they're fleeing war. If, however, they come from Albania, which is a very disordered country and a lot of gang violence and a lot of risks, but lacking a civil war, they may have to provide more proof, and most Albanians' claims for asylum are rejected. And then there's countries in between, and the level of proof that has to be provided will depend on the risk that the person says that they face.
So we come to this legislation, which is being put in the Commons and will get sort of read in the coming weeks, probably after recess, I'm guessing, at this point. What are the main changes to the system which are implemented by that legislation?
The main changes are those who come into the country by a route that the government considers to be illegal, in other words, by small boats, but without prior authorisation. They will essentially become second-class asylum applicants. They will be deemed ineligible to apply for asylum. And this is a very important provision, I think, for people to understand, because you cannot deny somebody asylum based on the route that they have used to come into the country. And, you know, we're signed up to the UN conventions and, you know, all the rest of that. And that simply would be found to be illegal. What this legislation seeks to do is to circumvent that and to suggest that people are ineligible to even apply. Now, this will be worked through the courts and there'll be challenges and all the rest of it. But that's one of the major provisions. If those second class asylum seekers, as categorised by the government, do manage to slip through and are given protection, that protection will be time limited, regularly reviewed with a view to sending them back, and they may have no rights to public services or access to health or state benefits. So essentially, they will be made destitute. So that's that group. And related to that, our proposals to consider the applications offshore in another country. The bill makes provision for people to have their cases heard and for them to be kept in what they call simple accommodation. And I think that would be like Napier Barracks. And it is not specifying where that accommodation might be, but it could be offshore. Now, there are lots of difficulties, I think, with this that the government itself is going to have to find a way through. The model is based on the Australian model, and Australia has had some reasonably convenient islands at its disposal, at least to make a start. We haven't. One of the problems that the government has faced over the years dealing with asylum is that its systems and processes are really poor. It's not a knowledgeable organisation in terms of understanding the background of asylum seekers. It's very, very bureaucratic, and its emphasis on stopping people coming in has meant that the whole process of trying to make a decision about asylum has been protracted, often found to be wrong. Frequently, the Home Office has acted illegally. And it has been very, very costly. Now, that's happened while those facilities have been in the UK, when the Home Office has access to thousands of staff to manage a system. Now, if you imagine offshoring that sort of system, the chances of having a swift, coherent, well-organised and well-ordered process are actually very slim. And I think this is one of the problems Australia has faced, that they simply cannot do the job well at a distance. The impression given is that Australia is quite happy that it doesn't do the job well because it hurts people who are applying for asylum. And it may be that that actually is the intention of the government. That's one major provision in this bill. There is something else that I think is significant that I think is slipping under the radar with the press. And that is, there are going to be new arrangements for entry into the UK. That includes for holidays. So it's like your landing card or whatever else, but it has to have been approved before you travel. This approval will apply to everyone, not just refugees, but it will apply to people coming to visit their families from anywhere in the world or coming on business. And this will mean that people without that, who will be refugees, a lot of them, will find themselves in a system that may lead to detention and deportation. And many of them will not be asylum seekers or refugees. Many will be just ordinary people who just haven't done the paperwork or have made a mistake. And in crafting new legislation to have an impact on asylum seekers, I think the government will find that it will widen its net and capture a lot of people who it has no intention of capturing. And this system simply is not designed to cope with this. We've already seen the difficulties for EU citizens in the UK. I think we can expect to see those difficulties magnified, you know, 100-fold going forward. So that's a change that I think doesn't initially appear to be significant, but has a significant impact, or will have a significant impact, and it will have a significant impact on people way beyond those seeking asylum. I mean, another provision, under the Dublin III regulations, we had the power to send back to a European country those who had come to the UK but had passed through a safe EU country. Yeah. It wasn't a power that was used a great deal. There weren't that many who managed to get to the UK. A lot of them had very good reason to. You know, there are a lot of reasons why you didn't do it too much. But the UK government accelerated this process just prior to Brexit, just prior to the actual leaving of the EU in the autumn of last year. And many more people were sent back. Individual EU countries have said that actually they're not very keen to take returnees. And the reason for this is fairly obvious, that most European countries, and certainly the European countries with the most refugees, have taken thousands more refugees than the UK. Mm. So they really don't want the few returnees. The UK is not yet taking its share, so they're not going to be encouraged to not follow its responsibilities or not maintain its responsibilities. So the government is proposing in the bill that the UK will still return people, and if EU countries do not cooperate, then the government will retaliate by putting constraints on the visas and the authorizations to enter the UK of citizens of those countries.
So for instance, say I'm a French citizen and the government of France refused to take back refugees to come from France. Yep. I would then have restricted rights coming to the UK following that.
Yes, that is the plan. And bearing in mind what I was saying just a moment ago about the other provision, everybody entering the UK will need prior authorization to do so, even if they're coming to see their families. You can see the direction that this would take. The bill specifically mentions, as an example, France, and it mentions it not as the safe country through which people have travelled, but the closest country to people embarking to cross the Channel.
Yeah.
So certainly France would be most impacted by this provision. What I think is worrying also is that apart from it being a rather nasty provision within the bill for people from another country with whom we're supposed to be friends, it will impact hugely on people in Britain. You know, their relatives are living in France. French people in the UK are married to British people. They would struggle to go home or to be able to return. We're talking about the intention to implement a cruelty that is totally disproportionate to the problem that the government thinks it has identified.
And you've actually done some big statistic sheets to go alongside your article for Yorkshire Bylines, which sort of details the actual state of asylum seeking in 2021. Could you talk a little bit through that now and actually what the reality is of what our situation with asylum seeking is?
If we take asylum applications, that's not an indication of how many people who want asylum are living in a country. It's just those who've made applications. So in the UK, in the year ending March 2021, the UK had 26,900 asylum applications. Now, if you compare that to Germany, Germany has nearly 100, it's just short of 122,000. It's that sort of difference. Now, those tens of thousands, we don't have them in the UK. You know, the people who get to the UK apply for asylum on arrival. There aren't hundreds of thousands of them floating around waiting to make an application. Now, if we think then about what sort of percentage of people in the UK are refugees, and it is less than 1.1%.
Yeah.
It's actually 0.6%. Now, if we compare that to some of the poorest countries of the world, like Lebanon, it has 21% of its population are refugees.
Really?
Jordan, it's 11%. Even Turkey is 5%. So our refugee population is absolutely infinitesimal in comparison with other countries. And it's absolutely infinitesimal in relation to the size of the problem internationally. There are 80 million displaced people, and 26 million are seeking asylum outside their country. Yeah. So if we take 300 people a year, as we did last year, or 1,200 this year, as we might if coronavirus reduces sufficiently to allow us to do that under the resettlement schemes, I think it would be 0.000 something of the world's refugees.
And this has been a quite, I guess, bleak picture of the situation as it is. But I'm not going to ask you to have a complete solution here, but what do you think we could be doing instead of this to actually make the system better for asylum seekers and better for the country as a whole?
Right. I think it's a problem that has to be addressed on a number of levels. I think internationally we need to do much more to prevent there being so many refugees. And that does mean taking our place amongst other countries. It does mean increasing the aid budget. It does mean supporting the UN efforts in refugee camp. So we must engage more fully. You know, if we are to be global Britain, then we need to be a global player solving problems that are actually worldwide. So that's the first level. The second level, I think, is the European level. And I do think that we have to work cooperatively with our European neighbours. And there is absolutely no reason at all why we can't take more refugees coming through the European route. Brexit does not preclude that. And if we were to work with our European colleagues, we might find that we have a better solution both to the European asylum problem, but also our channel crossing problem. Then within the UK, I think we need to consider how we manage it within the UK. One of the things that I think is most striking is under the resettlement scheme, asylum seekers are treated very well. And the scheme is comprehensive. It provides accommodation. It provides volunteer support. It provides English language tuition. And there's a whole sort of infrastructure and network to support the refugee in the UK. You know, in my ideal world, that's how it would be for everyone. But it costs about 40,000 for the initial cost for a refugee. And then people say, well, we can't afford it. And sometimes I think that the best can sometimes be the enemy of the good. Mm-hmm. That maybe we need to, I'm not saying that the scheme should be worse, but we could maybe engage communities more. We could think about provision differently, find a way of being able to expand it to accommodate more refugees and have a good standard for everyone. And then the final layer, I think, is about how we manage entry into the UK. And there are some proposals that if they worked well, I think would be very useful. And that is what they call a one-stop shop, mm-hmm. where there would be good advice, legal advice. That would allow stuff to be done more quickly, more efficiently, and hopefully more humanely. So that should help a bit. Personally, I would like us to open our doors just a little bit wider, but mainly, I think, to improve things on all the levels, from the UK entry level right through to the global level and preventing wars and famines and, you know, the other things that we can only influence, we can't control.
Thank you to all of our guests for speaking with us this week.
Be sure to follow us on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram at @BylinesPod for any and all future updates of this podcast.
Thank you to Jules for editing the episode. Our music, as always, was Voxel Revolution by Kevin McLeod. Thanks, Kevin.